Class is back in session. It's time for Baptist Basics University from BaptistBasics.org.
Welcome back to Baptist Basics University. I am Matthew Gage. This is lesson number six in... lesson number six in our series in the book of Daniel. It confuses me every time because I look and see the chapter number five, and it's a number off from the lesson. But anyway, lesson number six, going through chapter number five in the book of Daniel, as we look at the story of the handwriting on the wall. Let me set the stage for you in this one, because I think that to really get a good grasp of what is going on, you need to understand the background of the setting of chapter five, and you kind of get a glimpse of it towards the end, but there's some history and things I want you to be aware of as we're going through this chapter. So before we begin, I'm going to give you just kind of a historical introduction to this chapter. Let's begin this way. The Babylonian Empire lasted only about around 70 years or so. They're pretty short-lived, by standards of so many other empires. After Nebuchadnezzar, who reigned for a bulk of that, some 40 years or so, I don't remember exactly, the kingdom really kind of went into a period of chaos over the next, I think, about 10, 15 years it was. And there were numerous people who would rule for a little while, and then someone would usurp them. And so kind of a period of chaos that takes place during this time period. And part of also what's going on is Babylon is facing some, as they're dealing with these internal struggles, there's a growing external struggle they're having. You have the rise of a rival. You have the Medes and the Persians kind of form an alliance in what eventually will become the Persian Empire. And they are beginning to make some headway in gaining ground against Babylon. Now, Babylon is kind of modern Iraq on a globe or on a map. Persia is Iran. So it's a little bit further to the east, to the northeast, and the Medes and the Persians, this Medo-Persian Empire that's about to rise is gaining ground. They're beginning to put some pressure and kind of push the borders of Babylon back as they rise in power. Now, Babylon finally gains a little bit of stability under a ruler called Nabonidus, and who I think somewhere around 550 BC or so is when he came into power. And this guy, though, it's kind of interesting, even though he's the ruler of Babylon, the empire, he doesn't spend a lot of time in Babylon, the city. Turns out, evidently, he tried to introduce some religious reforms and was very unpopular in the city. So he ends up going away to a city called Tema. And at Tema, which was like a trading outpost, a oasis city, it was really more of a commercial center. So it was important. It wasn't just running and hiding somewhere. It was a very important town. Had to do with a lot of trade and stuff. So he ends up having to go there in about 553 BC and pretty much stays there for the rest of his reign. So while he's away, as we've already seen before, and where Nebuchadnezzar put Daniel kind of as the governor over Babylon, over the province of Babylon, he leaves his son kind of in Babylon, ruling over the city and over that province, kind of as a sub-king to himself. That person's name was Belshazzar, who we will meet in Daniel chapter 5. Now, Belshazzar is a very interesting person in the annals of history. We don't know a whole lot about him. In fact, for a number of years, a lot of critics would scoff at chapter 5 of Daniel because they say, well, there's no proof that Belshazzar ever existed. Well, they have now dug up proof that he did exist. But he is kind of the sub-king under his father, Nabonidus, and ruled beginning in about 553 BC. Has ruled over the city and province, the area there around Babylon. Now, who he is in relation, now I said Nabonidus is his father. There is some debate on that. There's proof that he's called his son, but there's some problems with it. Here's a couple of theories. One is that Belshazzar really is a son of Nebuchadnezzar, and that his mother, Nebuchadnezzar's widow, was married by Nabonidus when he rose to power, or maybe before he rose to power. So there's that theory. Also, there's a theory that maybe Nabonidus married Nebuchadnezzar's daughter, who then gave birth to Belshazzar, and that he is of blood kin to Nebuchadnezzar, but it's really, really unclear. And honestly, it doesn't really matter in the story, but just give you an idea of some theories out there and just give an illustration of just the murkiness of the historical records of this point. And a lot of that's because this is the final days, the final hours of the Babylonian Empire that we're dealing with in chapter 5. So, if there were good records, they may have been destroyed by the invaders. So, but there's a lot of murkiness this last days of the last years of the Babylonian Empire. So, Nabonidus is the king. His son Belshazzar is ruling over Babylon. Now, I'm gonna go ahead and really set the stage for that. That gives you an idea of what's going in Babylon, who Belshazzar is, who we're going to get into in Daniel chapter 5. Now, let me really set to you what's going on the night that this occurs. This takes place, Daniel chapter 5 takes place in October of 542 BC. We actually, and some people will even give a date, but I wasn't comfortable giving the exact date because, I've talked at length before about how goofy the calendars are and converting everything, so it's a little strange. I couldn't find one I put a lot of faith in, and I saw a couple different dates. As I said, the Medes and the Persians have been gaining power. They've been making progress. Nabonidus and his Babylonian army were defeated in the Battle of Opison in about 540 BC, just a couple years prior to the events of this night. And basically, by that point, the Babylonians weren't giving much resistance as the Medes and the Persians continued to march toward Babylon. It took them a little while to get there, various reasons, but by 542, the city of Babylon itself is under siege. It's surrounded. It's cut off. Now, Babylon was famed for its walls. It had gigantic walls, and there's kind of a debate on how big. There's some different numbers and measurements and stuff they're given in history, but it's a very well-fortified city. And what happens in a case like that is, you surround a city, it's too costly to attack it, so you starve them out most of the time. Well, until they get hungry or thirsty and give up. Well, a lot of times the cities would have, wells and different things to get water. In the case of Babylon, the Euphrates River ran through it. They actually built the city. The city was built around on both banks of the Euphrates River. They put the wall all the way around the city, including over the Euphrates River, and had like some bars or something underneath it. But the river actually ran under the walls and through the city of Babylon. So just an amazing, amazing story right there that they could even do that. But so they got water taken care of. They have tremendous amount of supplies. I mean, I remember this is a capital city. They've got all the major temples are there. There's a lot of supplies there. They can withstand the siege for a long, long time. Excuse me. Now, in October of 542, the evening that this takes place, Daniel chapter 5 takes place, the Medes and the Persians are outside the walls. And according to the Greek historian Herodotus, they've come up with a plan. And that plan was to attack Babylon. But not just a full-scale assault on the walls. What they were going to do was to dig a canal and divert the Euphrates River. So they had been working on this for a little bit of time, digging a ditch, a canal, that when it opened, the water from the Euphrates River would flow through it away from the city, and the water level would go down so that they could go in that riverbed, not completely dry, but would be able to go under the walls of Babylon through that river when it went down. So on this night, the final touches are being put on this plan, on this canal. As these events go in, that canal is opened and the water from the Euphrates is beginning to drain. And the armies of the Medes and the Persians are amassing and they're getting ready to enter the city of Babylon. Inside the city, they have the confidence that they're not going to fall. They have the confidence that the walls are too great, that they're too well supplied, that they can hold out this siege, and that Babylon the Great would not fall. It's also in the middle, evidently, of some type of a religious festival. And in the palace of Nebuchadnezzar, Belshazzar is hosting a feast in honor of these gods revolving around this pagan festival that seems to be taking place at this time of the year, some type of like a harvest festival of some sort. And in there, they are worshiping and praising their gods, the gods that they are hoping will have mercy on them, the gods that they hope will come to their rescue and save Babylon and bring victory to Babylon and this death and destruction to their enemies. And that is where we open up in Daniel chapter 5, verse 1. This feast is going on, as Belshazzar is hosting in the palace of Nebuchadnezzar, while outside, the troops are getting ready to invade the city and catch them all by surprise. Daniel chapter 5, verse 1. Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. So the great feast, 1,000 of his lords. So, it's a who's who. All the important people are there. It talks about him drinking wine before the 1,000. Most people think he's up like on a raised platform. If you've ever been to like a banquet or some sort, a lot of times you'll have the VIP table up at the front, and sometimes it's up on a little stage or something, and the people will be sitting up there at it. That's kind of what I imagine taking place here. So, and they're drinking wine, they're getting drunk. This is, something that a lot of times they would do in these type of situations in these festivals. And verse 2, Belshazzar, whilst he tasted the wine, so while he's drinking, he's getting a little drunk, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which his father, Nebuchadnezzar, had taken out of the temple which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes, his wives, and his concubines might drink therein. Okay, a few things I'll point out here. Number one, obviously the plan here that Nebuchadnezzar says, okay, we're worshiping our gods. Let's go get those bowls and cups and different things that Nebuchadnezzar took from Israel almost 70 years before. And let's take those and we'll use those because our gods are better than those Jewish gods. And this would just be celebrating our gods by showing how inferior the Jewish God is because, we're using their vessels to worship our God. his father, Nebuchadnezzar. Now, the term father is used quite a few times, and son is used in this. Those words don't have quite the literal meaning that we would take them for nowadays. The word father there can mean father. It can mean grandfather. It can mean even predecessor, like we think, you know, George Washington is the father of America or the father of nation, you know. Does that mean he's really the father or grandfather or blood relation or everybody? No, he just kind of founded it. So in this case, it's probably meaning something more the lines of grandfather or predecessor, that when it says thy father Nebuchadnezzar, maybe it may just mean that the predecessor to him, because he is a king. Well, the predecessor to him was Nebuchadnezzar. But most Bible scholars I've seen usually lean towards it meaning grandfather. But anyway, I just want to point that out. Verse 3. Then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem, and the king and his princes, his wives, and his concubines drank in them. So in the middle of this this pagan feast, they bring in these vessels, which actually, if you go back to chapter 1, verse 3, you can kind of see a little bit of mention of this, where they took all this stuff that was kind of non-vital to worship at Jerusalem. The temple wasn't destroyed at the time. They just took a bunch of stuff out of it, kind of as a ransom for the city. So verse 4, they drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. So they're praising all these polytheistic deities that they have with these sacred instruments from the temple at Jerusalem. Verse 5, in the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. And the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. So as this party is going on, the king looks over the crowd, and this is at night. So there's torches and lanterns and different things around this room. I imagine it's kind of smoky, kind of hazy. Everybody's a little tipsy from partying. And the king sees writing on the plaster of the wall, just can see part of a hand, not the entire hand, but just part of a hand, nothing else attached to it. But this hand is moving along the wall with a finger pointing out, and that finger is writing in the plaster on the wall. Now, a little note here, archaeologists have done some digging at Nebuchadnezzar's palace and the throne room. It had white plaster on the wall, so just further proof of of the Bible. So Nebuchadnezzar Belshazzar sees this hand. Verse 6. Then the king's countenance was changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his loins were loosed, and his knees smote one against another. So he is terrified at this sight, seeing this hand and seeing that writing on the wall. So much so, the joints of his loins were loose. Basically, he collapses. His knees smote one against another. Now, I've been kind of scared before, you know, different situations. I made the mistake of going into a haunted house thing one time. And even though I know it's all not real and, you know, stupid little dummies and stuff, it still scared me. And I remember shaking when I came out of that, you know, different things like that. But, I mean, this guy was shaking so bad his knees are actually knocking each other. And that is very scared. Verse 7. The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. And the king spake and said to the wise men of Babylon, whosoever shall read this writing and show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold about his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. So he's desperate now. He says, bring in everybody and I'm going to, you know, place a bounty on this. I will reward whoever can tell me what that writing means on the wall by giving them some things. And clothed in scarlet. Scarlet is a very expensive, royal, even cloth. The chain of gold, that'd be, you know, a symbolic of stature. Also very wealth, you know, quite a bit of wealth played with that. But third ruler in the kingdom. Remember what I said? Number one ruler is Nabonidus. Number two ruler is Belshazzar. And so the best he can offer is number three, because he's number two. So it kind of helps explain that verse. Verse 8. Then came in all the king's wise men, but they could not read the writing nor make known to the king the interpretation thereof. So once again, for what, the third time here in the book of Daniel, we bring in all the experts, and the experts can't read the writing. Or if they can read it, there's a chance of that, they can't figure out what it means. And when we get into it, we're going to see when we get to it, but it's four words, probably written in Hebrew or Aramaic, as the way Daniel reads them. And so, I mean, it's likely someone in that bunch knew how to read it, but if they did read it, it was just four words. What did it mean? And that was the part, the interpretation that they couldn't help with. But I think maybe they could read it. Somebody may could have. That's a reasonable assumption. Verse 9. Then was the king Belshazzar greatly troubled, and his countenance was changed in him, and his lords were astonished. So, I mean, the king of the country is scared, which is funny. A handwriting on the wall scares him. An army outside the gates doesn't scare him. So, anyway, it's kind of funny. Verse 10. Now the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet throne, banquet house, and the queen spake and said, O king, live forever, let not thy thoughts trouble thee, nor let thy countenance be changed. So the queen walks in. Notice, she wasn't there. This is probably an all men thing going on. There's probably not any women in there. That's some, even though it says, you know, his wives and his concubines, maybe they're there, maybe they're like in a separate room, but the queen herself is not there. Now this queen, most people believe this is not his wife, but this is the queen mother, that this is, his mom, which would be the wife of Nabonidus, maybe the widow of Nebuchadnezzar, maybe the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. We talked a little bit about that, but that's who this is. She's coming in speaking as a mom, not as a wife, but as a mom. Verse 11, there is a man in thy kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of thy father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him, whom the king Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, the king, I say, thy father, made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. So I think you already guessed who she's talking about. She's talking about old Daniel. Verse 12, forasmuch as an excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding, interpreting of dreams and showing of hard sentences and dissolving of doubts were found in the same Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar, now let Daniel be called, and he will show thee the interpretation. He will show the interpretation, excuse me. So she steps in and says, hey, don't worry about this. I know somebody that can solve this. There's a man named Daniel. He's done this kind of stuff before. He's got a reputation. I kind of like the stuff about his reputation. Excellent spirit. That's not talking about the Holy Spirit. That's talking about his attitude, his personality, the knowledge and understanding that he's smart. Interpreting of dreams, we've seen him do that. Showing of hard senses, you know, we've kind of seen that too. Dissolving of doubts. I think if I remember right in the Hebrew, that says something about dissolving of knots. But basically, you know, he could solve problems. That very wise man is what they're saying about Daniel. So, verse 13. Then was Daniel brought in before the king. And the king spake and said unto Daniel, art thou that Daniel which art of the children of the captivity of Judah, whom the king my father brought out of Jewry? And by the way, let me point out, that was almost 70 years prior to this. So Daniel, by this time, is probably in his 80s. This is an old man that is standing before the king. Verse 14, I have even heard of thee, that the spirit of the gods is in thee, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom is found in thee. Verse 15, you know, starts out, oh, are you Daniel? I've heard about you. You're a great guy. Verse 15, he's going to tell him about the problem. And now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and make known unto me the interpretation thereof, but they could not show the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of thee, that thou canst make interpretations and dissolve doubts. Now, if thou canst read the writing and make known to me the interpretation thereof, thou shalt be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold about thy neck, and shalt be third ruler in the kingdom. So He's laid it all out. Says, Daniel, here's the deal. I want to know what that writing over there on the wall says. No one else can answer it. And if you'll do it, you'll get the same reward as anybody else. So verse 17. Then Daniel answered and said before the king, let thy gifts be to thyself and give thy rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing unto the king and make known to him the interpretation. And I think Daniel takes one look at the writing. I think he knows what it means. He knows what's going on. I think he knows you don't want a part of being honored by a king who's about to fall. It's not a safe position to be in. Verse 18. O thou king, the most high God gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. So he's going to start out, I kind of like this. Daniel starts out by reminding them of the story of the previous chapter about how Nebuchadnezzar had gone mad. In verse 19, and for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him, whom he would he slew, and whom he would he kept alive, and whom he would he set up, and whom he would he put down. That's the might and the power and the authority that Nebuchadnezzar had. Verse 20, but when his heart was lifted up and his mind hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. In verse 21, and he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild asses. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appointeth over it whomsoever he will. So Daniel's telling this to remind them, you remember Nebuchadnezzar made a mistake, he was too lifted up with pride, you see that he fell. Verse 22, and thou his son, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all this. So he's like, Belshazzar, you knew what happened to Nebuchadnezzar, you knew why it happened, you know, probably by his own mouth or his own writings, his own account. He knew what had happened to him and knew why. Verse 23, but hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before thee, and thou and thy lords, thy wives and thy concubines have drunk wine in them, and hast praised the gods of silver and of silver and gold, of brass, iron, wood, and stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know, and that God in whose hand thy breath is, and whose are all thy ways, hast thou not glorified. So, well, he starts preaching to him right here. He tells him, he said, you know, you're lifted up with pride. You've taken those vessels of God, of the most holy God, and have used them to worship idols. And I like the little dig he gets in those idols, you know, says that they see not, nor hear, nor know. He's like, you know, you're to worship gods that don't even exist. And that, you know, the God who lets him breathe, you know, you haven't glorified. You've been busy, you know, worshiping these idols, and the one that lets you live and makes the sun come up in the morning is the one, you know, you're desecrating the vessels of his temple. So verse 24, then was the part of the hand sent from him, and this writing was written. So verse 25, we get into the writing on the wall and its interpretation. And this is the writing that was written. Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upharsin. And, you know, the great thing about the book of Daniel right here in this, Daniel almost summarizes this as well as anybody, any commentary I looked at. Verse 26, this is the interpretation of the thing. Mene, God hath numbered thy kingdom and finished it. Mene means numbered or counted. Kind of like taking a census kind of idea to it, that basically time's up. You've reached the allotment. You've crossed the line. Days are over. Mene, mene is twice that God's gave him a second chance, that God prolonged it, but it's over. God has numbered the kingdom and finished it, that the end of Babylon is come. Tekel, verse 27, Tekel, thou art weighed in the balances and art found wanting. Tekel means weighed, balance. Imagine, you know, the old-fashioned scale where, you know, you have the, on both sides, you know, and you weigh it and try to balance it out and determine the weight. I don't know if you're a player of those in school or you've seen them. I'm sure you've seen them, but don't use them a lot nowadays. But basically, you know, what God expected, what Babylon was and Belshazzar was weighed against what God expected. Now, that's not, you know, people picture that for salvation. Sometimes that's not what this is talking about. But as a kingdom, as a ruler, God expected something out of Belshazzar. And it was found wanting. So he didn't match up with what God expected. Perez, verse 28, Perez. Thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Now, you think, well, wait a minute. Verse 25, it says Upharsin. Verse 28, it says Perez. Well, I can explain that. I actually just learned this. I was kind of curious about that myself. Upharsin, to break it down, U means and. And Pharsin is the plural of Perez. So basically it's multiple. So it's being divided multiple plural idea of being divided. That's what Perez means. Perez means means divided. Like you would divide out food and give each person their portion. And the kingdom is divided and is given to the Medes and Persians. And some people say, some people I read even said there's a little play on words there that Perez is very similar or would sound like Persia. And so there may be a little play on words there that's being divided and given to the Persians. But at the end of this, they've been, you know, the days of Babylon are up. You know, when God judged or came to Belshazzar and he was judged, weighed in the balances. He did not measure up to God's expectations. So now finally, it's over. The kingdom is divided. It's now given away to someone else. Just like, you know, think of an inheritance kind of thing. You know, after someone passes away, all their stuff will be distributed to, you know, the different heirs. Well, the heir to Babylon is going to be the Persian Empire that comes. So there we go. Daniel delivers the message. Mene, mene, Tekel, Upharsin. And so what do they do? Verse 29. Once again, you know, it's a very negative message. Daniel keeps having to come in and deliver. Verse 29. That they then commanded Belshazzar, and they clothed Daniel with scarlet and put a chain of gold about his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. So I can imagine Daniel saying, I don't really want this. If you looked over the gates and you see who's coming, I really don't want to be a major ruler in this kingdom. But they go ahead and honor him like they said they would. And then verse number 30. And that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, slain. While that party was taking place, while the ham was riding on the wall, while Daniel interpreted the dreams, while they put the scarlet robe and golden chain and printed the proclamation underneath those walls of Babylon, came an army. And the mighty city of Babylon that had dominated the region, been an empire for almost 70 years, fell that night without a fight. The army just comes in and takes over. And Babylon, the city, is now under control of the Persians, or more properly, the alliance of the Medes and the Persians, which we'll talk more about them probably next time. Verse 31, and Darius the Median took the kingdom, being about 62 years old. And we'll talk about Darius the Mede next time too, in chapter 6. But right here, verses 30 and 31, if you go back to chapter 2 and verse number 39, that is the fulfillment right here in chapter 30 and verses 30 and 31, chapter 5, chapter 2, verse 39. Or really, if you go to verse 38, where it talks about the statue that Nebuchadnezzar saw, and it talks about the head of gold in verse 38. And 39 says, and after thee shall rise another kingdom inferior to thee. That kingdom just arose. And if you look at that statue like a timeline, it's now passed out of that head of gold and gone into the silver, to that the chest and breast and arms of silver. So what has happened right here is now Cyrus the Great, ruler of the Medes and the Persians, is now the ruler of basically the world in their eyes, of that entire area. And now Darius the Mede, we're introduced to him. He wasn't the leader, but he is the man that takes over ruling Babylon and the Babylonian province. You know, it didn't come in and become the new capital, but it stays a regional and very important city after the fall of the empire. So Darius the Mede is the one left in charge of that. So there we go. That is Daniel chapter 5. The Babylonian Empire, which takes up so much of the book of Daniel, so much of what happens takes place in that. I mean, 5 of the 6 historical chapters and even the prophetic chapters take place in this. But Babylon the Great has fallen, and the Persian Empire rises. But God's not done with Daniel. God's not done with his people. And we'll see in chapter 6 that Daniel continues on in an honored place, and God is still using him in the court of a new king and a new empire. So there we go. I actually got through that a lot quicker than I expected to. So we'll see you next time as we wrap up the historical portion of the book of Daniel, when we get into chapter 6 and Daniel in the lion's den, when, you know, Daniel, the 80-something-year-old man, is thrown to the lions. I'm sure you've seen many pictures of an elderly person being thrown to the lions. So anyway, I appreciate you listening today. I hope it's been a help and a blessing to you. Check out BaptistBasics.org for other resources. Follow BaptistBasics.org on Facebook. That's where I put the most news and updates. That's about it. I appreciate you listening today.